admit at the outset, I don't profess any great expertise in this field of raising children. Even though, Baruch Hashem, I'm blessed with children and grandchildren. First of all, as all of you know, I only have a minor role in that effort. We all know who really gets the overwhelming credit. And it's also a subject that it's difficult to actually, I think, for anyone to profess that they've mastered the raising of children. So what I'd like to do is give you some ideas that I've sort of thought about over the years, plus discussions with other people, including my children. As part of the reason I can't profess any expertise in this field is that two of my children, my two sons, both became rabbis. So that automatically, in a sense, disqualifies me. But despite that, let me plunge ahead. And I'd like to pose also, I think, a question in a few minutes, which actually is a question that I just talked to a woman who had asked me that question. I didn't even remember it from about 15 years ago. So let me begin with a quote. There's a book called Far From the Tree. It's by a man named Andrew Solomon. It's actually a very famous book. It's gotten extraordinary amount of response. And it's based on the notion of the child that falls far. Usually we say, right, that the child doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. And the premise of the book is that that's not true. That virtually every child, in some way, is far from the tree. And usually, I think, parents struggle with that, or perhaps are even shocked by it. Here's the opening paragraph of the book. There's no such thing as reproduction. When two people decide to have a baby, they engage in an act of production. And the widespread use of the word reproduction for this activity, with its implication that two people are but braiding themselves together, is at best a euphemism to comfort prospective parents before they get in over their heads. In the subconscious fantasies that make conception look so alluring, it's often ourselves that we would like to see live forever, not someone with a personality of his own. Having anticipated the onward march of our selfish genes, many of us are unprepared for children who present unfamiliar needs. Parenthood abruptly catapults us into a permanent relationship with a stranger. And the more alien the stranger, the stronger the whiff of negativity. We depend on the guarantee in our children's faces that we will not die. I have to get up for just a moment. Good morning. Welcome. Rav Shraya. Children whose defining quality annihilates that fantasy of immortality are a particular insult. We must love them for themselves and not the best of ourselves in them, and that is a great deal harder to do. Loving our own children is an exercise for the imagination. This book basically deals with, to use his term, when we think of parenthood as kind of vertical, that very often our children present us with horizontal issues that are not, so to speak, falling within that parent-child continuum. And I think for us, as religious Jews, this is true as parents in general, but we find our children, shockingly, are not like us, or they have different ideas, and we're confused by it. Why is my child not acting the way I expect him or her to? And it's the eternal issue. I mean, basically, the first sefer in Chumash is about that issue. How to deal, how to cope with children that are not like their parents. So that's sort of the launching point for me. And so what I'd like to do is just suggest some ideas that I think Chazal and Torah and that how do we get, in a sense, our children to say yes? Or how do we say yes to our children when they are perhaps acting in a way that we find shocking? Does this resonate with anybody? Does anybody have any children like that, or is it just me? Is it the only one that? Okay, I guess so. I'm alone. So let's talk about dealing with children that are different. So first of all, as I mentioned in Sefer Bereishis, that's a common issue, right? How do we deal with the fact that one child is not acting the same as the other child? So actually, interesting, Rav Hirsch has a very, I think, kind of radical idea. And he raises the following question. We understand that Yishmael could be the son of Avraham and act differently than Avraham probably hoped he would. That's a whole interesting area, how Avraham, there are fascinating midrashim about how Avraham continued to maintain contact with Yishmael. There are amazing Yalkut Shimonis on Avraham going to visit alone without his wife, going to visit Yishmael, who's living out in the desert. Sort of has sort of Arab sort of connotations. His wife's name, by the way, is Fatima in the Medrash. Yishmael's wife is Fatima. You know who Fatima was? I think that was Muhammad's wife. And he goes and he's concerned about him. And some of those Midrashim are fascinating because he leaves a message for him and comes back. But Hirsch's question is, he gets the fact that Avraham could have a Yishmael. Why? Well, his mother is problematic, right? The mother is Hagar, right? So we would presume that whoever and whatever Hagar is, she's not Sarah, right? So we understand that, or at least he does. His question is, how did Yitzchak and Rivka have an Esau? How did they have an Esau? How could that be? So what's the answer? One answer is that's what happens. You know, it just happens. So he has an interesting, and I think whether it's the reason or not, but it's, I think it's a wonderful insight. He says the reason is, if you look at the psukim of Yitzchak, of Yaakov and Esav growing up, the Torah presents that they are raised, and then it says Vayigdalu haNe'arim, and they developed and they matured and they grew up, and suddenly Vayi Esav Ish Yodei Atzayin Yisadeh, right? Esav is this wild guy, this hunter, whatever. And Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Oalim. Hirsch says What this indicates is a mistake. The mistake being that they were raised identically until they grew up. That what was wrong with that upbringing was that somehow they didn't differentiate in the way they approached each child. And they didn't view that child, so to speak, as an individual. But these are our children. This is the way we raise them. And therefore, they were raised identically. And if you raise each child identically, identical to the other, this could happen. It's a shocking shot.
So was that because they were twins, or because they were just raised the
same way? They were raised identically, he claims. And if you raise each child exactly the way the other one was raised, you can miss it. Mm-hmm. Because there's differences. There has to be differences. And we know that there are differences. They that idea of each one being different. Actually, also going back to Bereshis a little bit, going back maybe a little bit earlier, is a question the Kli Yoker raises on why is it that why is it that Avraham, when he's looking for a wife for Yitzchak, is willing to allow his son to marry from people who are problematic. Right, who are Ovdei Avodah Zarah, but he's not willing to have a daughter-in-law who comes from the local murderers and thieves. Why? Why is he willing to compromise on the issue of believing in Hashem and go and get a child or boy, a girl, sorry, from people who don't believe in God? And yet, he's willing to have somebody who's not won't allow somebody who comes from a people that are murderers and thieves like the Canaanite. And he has, I think, a wonderful answer. And I think this goes to the question that there are only two issues, basically. He says, one is character, and the other is belief. Or you could say one is sort of your morality, your ethics, and the other is your being an Eved Hashem, your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He said, Kli Yoker basically says that character is inherent. It's automatically sort of passed on. Belief, that can be taught. Your religious commitment can be developed. How to do that? That's partly what we're talking about as well. But fundamental is character. That automatically somehow gets passed on. Again, you could argue with that as well, but in a certain sense, the idea that each child has to be dealt with differently. Look at Bereshis ultimately ends with brachos. What are those brachos of Yaakov? Each one is different than the other. Each one gets his own bracha. It's what Yaakov, in effect, is wishing for his child. He doesn't get up and say, I wish you all should be Shomer Torah mitzvahs and you all should be nice people. Goodbye. No. Each one is a world. Each one is a universe. Each one is shockingly different. And that's partly what that book is so successful in dealing with. It's talking about, let's say, from this book, Far From the Tree, it's talking about the idea of a child who is maybe different in very different ways. In other words, a child, let's say, who's a child who has an issue, a child who's autistic, as we show, a child who has other kinds of... So the resistance and the difficulty in engaging that child is really the real struggle, and in a certain sense, the real avoda. You know, yesterday in the parsha by the Levim struck me. This is this unusual phrase. It talks about by Levim that they have this avodas matana. The avodas matana generally is understood to mean that their task as Levim in leading the Jewish people is that they handle their matanot. They're handling their gifts, their offerings. That's their avoda. So I think it's Hirsch who says also that, no, avodas matana is to teach the idea that that work is giving. To be a leader means you're giving, which is maybe also an interesting contrast of Vayikach Korach at the beginning of the parasha. It talks about ultimately Levim being givers. And what is a parent, in a sense? Leading children by essentially giving. So, how do we do that? So let me read to you an excerpt from, anybody ever look at Tablet magazine online? Anybody ever see it? No? You've seen it. So actually the young lady grew up in my shul as the editor-in-chief of Tablet. She's a very talented young lady. Anyway, this is written by a fellow, and he wrote it publicly, so I'll use his name. His name is Simon Yisrael Feuerman. He's the son of a Rav Feuerman from Staten Island, the yeshiva foundation. What was it called? Foundation. Right. So here's the title of the piece, and you'll tell me your reaction. The title is "When Shabbos Is the Longest Day." It was a long July Shabbos some years ago. If you grew up observant, you remember how long this kind of Shabbos seemed when you were a child. Endless. Like summer itself. A long July Shabbos is enough to turn even a devout child into a young apostate. Enough to make you deny Moshe and all of God's Torah. Out of kindness to our little children and ourselves, we had decided to leave our Brooklyn home and go to a place where Shabbos could pass more quickly, less painfully, and more interestingly to a child. Ocean Grove on the Jersey Shore. Anybody ever been there? It's below Asbury Park and above Bradley Beach. We would stay at a bed and breakfast, and there was a shul within walking distance in Bradley Beach. But there was also beachside playgrounds nearby where our kids could enjoy the long Shabbos afternoon. Ocean Grove was originally founded as a camp meeting for Methodists, and it has retained some of that culture even as it has become a destination of all kinds of people. We had never spent Shabbos in such an environment before. As the sun set on Friday evening, there was a festive air. People gathered on the veranda of our guest house to eat dinner. I noticed a round, red-faced man eating lobster nearby as I quietly sang Shalom Aleichem. Just inside the parlor, a short man played the piano with a small and we made kiddush with a small silver becher that we had brought along while he played piano in the background. I enjoyed it. There was something homey, quaint about this place, yoking these opposites together in a sort of spiritual plaid. We got up, snooted wife and yarmulked little kids, trekked across the porch and the parlor to wash our hands. Some people watched us and our young family, most ignored us. As the pianist continued to play, there was a noisy giddiness in the room and some people started to dance. After a while, the last tune was played on the piano and the place emptied out. It was a beautiful evening, and we decided to go for a walk. As we were stepping down from the porch, the pianist passed us, about to get into a waiting cab, and said, "Good Shabbos." My mother had a terrible fear of the streets, a catch-all term for the outside world, rife with lusts and formless enemies that would snare her children. For her, there was no neutral ground for cultures to meet, no safe place for mingling of ideologies. She was completely under the sway of the mistrust of the Goyisha culture as being wholly corrupting. One could read a book or listen to Gentile music but the lure of their culture up close, like sitting and eating with Goyim in Ocean Grove, would have been too much. We would all succumb in the end, she believed, if we allowed ourselves to be too close. I'll skip a little bit. My wife suggested the next day that we delay eating in the afternoon until 1 o'clock and drag it out for an hour or so, and then go upstairs back to our room because it began to rain heavily. And that would lull everyone to a deep afternoon Shabbos nap. But it was not to be. At around 2:45, Avigail, my daughter, woke up from a short nap, nudged me awake. I looked at the clock, 6 more hours till Shabbos was over. The others were still asleep. It was pouring. I had no idea what to do. We went downstairs. There were people playing cards and checkers. Suddenly, someone put on the television. A movie was starting from the beginning. Stuart Little. I don't know the movie. I sat down in direct sight of the television. Abigail said, "But Daddy, it's Shabbos." I put a finger over my lips. "Shh." Abigail first sat in my lap, and then we sat together on the floor. Talks about the movie a little bit. We watched the movie together. This wasn't technically forbidden since we had not turned on the television, but nevertheless, I had never done that before. I had in my bone marrow passed down from the old world that Yiddishkeit had to be accepted with an austerity, even a form of monasticism. Yet I knew what worked for me would not work for my daughter. I knew I could lose her, even at this young age, if I did not do something, if I did not bend somehow to make this Shabbos tolerable. She needed me to exceed my boundaries, if only so that she could accept hers. I'll stop there. You agree?
No.
You disagree? Why?
Because it was the wrong place to go for Shabbos. They should have gone to a... I know I took a bungalow up in the Catskills where my children were there, and we had a beautiful Shabbos.
Right.
It was an onik Shabbos. They had a party. They had refreshments. They were singing Zmiros.
Okay.
You don't go to Ocean Grove, New Jersey, where the bunch of goyim are sitting there in a hotel. You don't have to do it that way. You could do it. You send the kids to sleepaway camp. There are many ways of doing it. That is not the right way to do it.
So in the setting, though, okay, granted that. So if the setting is wrong, putting that aside for the moment, but he's in that moment. He made a mistake.
He did.
He made a mistake, but now what does he do Shabbos afternoon with the movie?
Well, he made a mistake, he did, and then the next Shabbos he doesn't go back.
No, but I'm asking about on that Shabbos. We've passed the point. He made a mistake. He's stuck. He's now made a decision to watch this movie with his daughter. Did he make, in your view, the right decision, given the mistake he had already made? What do you say?
I think a parent has to use their own gut feelings and their own ideas and not be too strict, too rigid, and he knew his child. And his reasoning seemed to be quite, you know, reasonable. So I think he did not make a mistake.
I absolutely think he made the right mistake because he was allowed.
He made the right mistake?
Right choice.
Oh, right choice, okay.
Given the mistake because he allowed his wife to get a Shabbos rest. Otherwise, that little girl would have been nudging and waking her up. So if the only place to go was, he never anticipated it was going to rain on Shabbos and couldn't go to the playground, was downstairs, he did the right thing. And he kept her away so the rest of the family could sleep.
Right.
That was the wife's intention.
So
everybody should have a long Shabbos nap to help Shabbos pay.
Right. So I think, you know, I don't think that there's a right or wrong answer, obviously. And I think...
Does he say how old the girl is?
Sorry. I think she was about 6 or 7.
She knew it was Shabbos.
She said, "Daddy, Shabbos."
Yeah, so I don't know why he thinks that it would have been too rigid. At that age, I read a lot to my children. Very lazy, because you sit a kid in front of
Well, he is a psychologist, but
he's a father.
You bring up your kids without a TV, and for so you get used to having to be interacting with them a lot more. Mm-hmm. You can't just sit them there and have them entertained by something else. I mean, now it's impossible to escape with the devices, but
right.
My kids were that age. I read to them a lot.
Right.
That's what I would do.
Right. Again.
Oh, they were sitting in the lobby.
Uh-huh.
So they sat in view of the TV on purpose. First of all, you never go without books.
Right.
I hear.
Okay.
Instead of taking books, could have taken toys, kids that age play with Tinker Toys. They play with lots of things at that age. In fact, a child that age should be playing more than just sitting in front of a screen. Any pediatrician would agree.
Right.
That at that age, they should still be able to do
Yeah,
next.
Well, now that's all they're in front of.
It's just much easier to sit in front of a screen.
I don't
have something else entertaining them. Down on the floor with them.
Yeah. So clearly, I mean, the overall issue of how to parent is, you know, but I think I was trying to hone in on the issue of that question of, can you individually decide that this might be the best thing for your child, and who is the best person to make that decision? Obviously, the mother who was sleeping would have been the right one.
But the kid herself said, if she said, but it's job,
right.
Like,
Right. But there also seemed to have been a tension that he expressed earlier that his child had about Shabbos and complaining about it.
Sure.
Right.
But it does
right.
take a lot more effort.
Right.
To
right. Okay.
I don't know how many years ago this was, but having grown up here in the Five Towns, Shabbos was very different when I was growing up than what our children and grandchildren experience today. And I know we made a conscious decision in their formative years to take them away one Shabbos a year to a place where it wasn't so easy to have Shabbos, where they had to anticipate ahead. We had to make the arrangements of what we were going to do, where we'd be able to daven, where we could either bring food or have food and have a Shabbos atmosphere. So I understand what he was trying to do as a parent to make Shabbos palatable.
Right. I think there's but the larger issue that I wanted to also just touch on is that sometimes it is right to try to find a way to say yes. That, again, every child is different, but there are some children who need more yes than no. Other children, I think, will tolerate or even want no more than yes. But the default, I think very often for religious parents, is a no. Even though some might argue today that the default is yes, 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 whatever you want, you know, because God forbid I should impose any kind of restriction on the child. But I think that question of balance, you know, what Chazal talk about of Mekarev v'yamin v'docheh v'smol, right? That the stronger hand is the pulling in, the positive, the yes. And the weaker hand is the no, is the pushing away, or the negative approach. And that, and all of us know as parents or as children, that sometimes parents are not able to find that balance. That children feel that you're always saying yes to my brother, but you're always saying no to me, you know. What's that?
You got to know when to pick your battles.
Picking battles.
Is that what it comes to?
Right.
Or
maybe not battling.
It's a quote, but
maybe not battling.
You
have
to know when to say yes, when to say no. Each child being different.
Right.
Sometimes you say no to him.
Right. That idea of the individual child. I know a rabbi.
Right.
Who had a child who was having difficulty with Shabbos. I won't mention any names, but I'll just tell you the story. He's a recognized Orthodox rabbi. And it was a controversial decision. He made it public. And he said his child was just obsessed with art, with painting and with art. And she said, "Daddy, I need to draw on Shabbos." I think she was about maybe 7 or 8 years old. And he said, "Go in a private room and do it." Now, again, I don't don't know that I would have said it. I don't know that you would have said it. This is what he said. And he later, and years later, said it was the absolutely right thing to do, to allow her to do it, to get that right, rather than, and I think what we all struggle with is the fact that there is that dissonance, like that original thing. It's not reproduction. It's not reproducing that you have the model, and I'm just reproducing that model that I am. Now, the other factor, I don't have to say it because you all know it, is that there's another issue that always usually plays into this, and that is that there generally are two parents. And very often, what was the old Beatles song? You say yes, I say no. You say goodbye, I say hello. That dissonance between parent and parent is a huge issue, as we know, as our children play one off the other, or parents are working out their own internal struggles with each other through their kids. And we see that also in Sefer Bereishis. We see the struggle parents with each other and the sort of quiet tension going on between them. So I'll just conclude with this. The end of this piece reads as follows. By the time the movie ended, the bulk of the day had passed. But more than that, we had felt cleansed somehow as we snacked happily on slices of watermelon. Everyone else in the family had slept through the afternoon, but she and I had watched the movie. We both knew in our Jewish souls that something pure had been accomplished with this sin in this church town of Ocean Grove. I had the feeling that all the polemics in the world could not have instilled greater love of Shabbos than this conspiracy and the successful transgression we engaged in together. As the day drew up to a close, the rain finally abated. We went to the patch of lawn, the commons in front, under a turquoise sky, fast turning purple. We counted out three stars for the Shabbos end. In all the years since, I never heard a complaint about Shabbos again. So that's not a psak halacha. But I think hopefully it's a little bit of an insight that sometimes we say that saying yes is actually something that is helpful. Somebody once noted to me that in the first time Hashem communicates with man in the Gan, in the garden, first he tells them, what does he say to Adam? First, that you should echol mikol pri hasadeh. First, eat. Yes, you can eat. And then he says, however, no, cannot eat from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. So Hashem's first offering is not, no, don't eat from, but he begins with the yes. Yes?
The child said it's Shabbos. I'm just thinking of something that we went through. When my child was 5 years old, he had his tonsils removed and we were at LIJ. After the procedure, we missed dinner and they bought Jell-O. The Jell-O was green and I said to my husband, it really doesn't look kosher. And my son must have heard, and he was 5 years old. And he looked at it and I said, do you have to eat it? He goes, no, it doesn't look kosher. He would not touch it.
Right.
So my husband ran around looking for a karfel that was open. He brought in the karfel and he ate it. And I thought, 5 years old. He said it's not kosher. He refused to eat. I'm going to fast forward 25 years later because I thought it was nice and commendable. My youngest daughter was getting married. My son lives in Israel. He was coming in for the wedding on Sunday. Everybody's wearing tuxedos. He calls me on Friday morning. He says, you have the tuxedo in the basement? I said, I think it was ruined in the Sandy storm. He goes, I'm going to go run and buy another tuxedo, but I'm not wearing it unless it's tested for shotness. And I'm thinking to myself, the wedding is on on Sunday. It's Erev Shabbos. You're buying a tuxedo. Who's going to check out? What are you going to do? And I'm thinking back, and I said, you know what? The child said, it's not kosher. I'm not eating it. 25 years later, he refuses to wear a tuxedo unless it's checked for Shabbos. And I said, but I think you're allowed to wear something once before it's whatever. He goes, I'm not putting it on. And literally 10 minutes before Shabbos, I got through to the Shabbos hotline. And he said, just give me the brand and I'll tell you whether there's a question or not. I told him the name of the company and he said, no problems at all. And he wore the tuxedo on Sunday and I said to him, I can't believe it, you know. But it started because he said, I'm not going to do it. He was only five. So if the child really said it's Shabbos, maybe the father should have thought to himself, you know what, if she already knows it's Shabbos, why am I going to change anything? So even though I can agree that sometimes you have to go off, but if the young child already understands something, then we should let it go. Because you don't know that
well
it's
said.
Right?
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.